This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. As of this moment, there are 119 confirmed cases of novel coronavirus COVID-19 in Ohio. There are 8 in Butler County, 2 in Hamilton County, and 1 in Montgomery County. We have 33 cases that have required hospitalization, according to the state of Ohio. In Kentucky, there are 47 confirmed cases, including one announced this week in Kenton County. Today, we will talk with two infectious disease experts and take your phone calls at 513-419-7100. I do want to share a bit of news that just came into our inbox from the city of Cincinnati. We don't know a whole lot of details yet, but at 12:30, the city of Cincinnati will provide an important update. This is what they're calling it, an important update on the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in Cincinnati. Mayor John Cranley, city manager Patrick Duhaney, and health commissioner Melba Moore will be talking to the media at 12:30. So that will be during our show. We will try to bring you updates from that news conference as we get them. But we start our show today with Summa Health Infectious Disease Division Chairman and Infectious Diseases Society of America President, Dr. Thomas Feil. He joins us on the phone. Dr. Feil, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, good afternoon, Michael.
It's our pleasure to have you. And I know we're probably talking about a lot of the same things almost every day, but it seems like we can't reinforce enough a lot of these issues surrounding coronavirus, COVID-19. And I just want to start with the fact that places in California, Los Angeles, New York City, for example, asking people to shelter in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19. That's a little more extreme than what we're hearing in our places about social distancing and trying to telecommute to work and that sort of thing. Could you just tell us why in those places these measures are important or needed?
Well, first of all, let me just say it reinforces the concept and the need, actually, for social distancing, because we know that this virus is primarily transmitted person to person, particularly where there's relatively close contact. And you've all heard about the 5 to 6 feet rule type of thing. And so it's really important for all the listeners to be aware of that and to comply with all the policies regarding social distancing. Don't have large gatherings. Don't go to meetings where there's more than 10 people, and try to stay away from people who are sick. If you are sick, stay at home, etc. So I think it depends to some extent as to the size of the area and the densely populated area is how successful that's going to be. So if you look at maybe Los Angeles, if you look at New York, obviously very, very concentrated population. And so it may need this type of enforced type of social distancing to be effective. But I can't stress enough to our listeners how important it is to find social distancing recommendations, as well as personal health aspects such as hand washing and, you know, trying to avoid sick. And if you are sick, to stay at home.
Dr. Feil, it seems like different jurisdictions are responding differently. I think for the most part, all of the governments are at least addressing this as a very serious matter and reinforcing that to citizens. But when you do have some places that are virtually on some sort of lockdown and then others where, you know, it's not as strict, some restaurants, for example, you're still allowed to operate. What does that do nationally if this disease is so contagious?
Well, I think it does create some confusion and maybe the feeling on some people that maybe we're overreacting. But let me just say we're not overreacting. I mean, we have an opportunity now to try to, and I'm sure you've heard about this, flatten the curve. That is to lessen the number of patients who acquire infection, at least acquire infection that requires or that has to go into the hospital, because we don't want to overwhelm our healthcare system, as we've seen both in China and Italy. So it is important to do that. And as far as, you know, what the perception is of different rules or regulations, that's going to depend to a certain extent on specific local characteristics. I mean, whether schools are closed like here in Ohio or some states have decided not to close schools, it is going to depend to a certain extent on the specific characteristics of a location. But I think what we're doing in Ohio here is very appropriate. I think the leadership of the governor, as well as the director of public health here, Dr. Amy Aston, has been extremely good.
And we are talking with Dr. Thomas Feil right now. And Dr. Feil, you heard me say as we were introducing this segment that there are 119 confirmed cases in Ohio. And that's an important distinction because those are cases that are confirmed. It does not mean that there are not more cases right. than that. How should we talk about that?
Well, I agree with you. That's probably, and it's because we've had limited capacity of testing, which I think is going to be improved significantly in the next week or so as more commercial labs are ramping up to be able to handle tens of thousands of samples. But, you know, up until about maybe 10 days ago, there was really no testing capacity in Ohio at all. Then the Ohio Department of Health has developed their testing technique, and we have some commercial labs to which we can send. But right now, the turnaround time for those commercial labs is about 5 to 6 to 7 days. And so we really need for that to be quicker in order for us to optimally evaluate and manage our patients. And so that's extremely important. So many of our institutions, including us, are in the process of developing our own in-house tests so that we can have more rapid ability to diagnose these patients and then treat them appropriately. But I think when we start having more capability of testing, you're going to see that those numbers are going to go way up. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that the incidence is going up. It just means that now with increased capacity to test, we're just going to be able to identify all of the patients, or not all of them, but a large number of them who are infected. So because, as you said, the 119 is the documented cases. We don't know all the other cases that we have not been able to test yet because of the limitations of capacity.
And Dr. Fall, you mentioned that because of the shortage of tests, or the lack of availability of tests, I should say, that your organization may start looking to do something in-house. Could you tell us what that would look like?
Well, actually, we're developing. We've acquired the instrumentation and the reagents to do the test. We're going to be doing some validation. And then we have to have approval for some of our platforms from the FDA. The FDA has allowed for an emergency utilization authorization, but we need to get that clarified before we can start actually utilizing the test. But it does take some time for what we call validation, even when we have the appropriate reagents and equipment. We're hoping that will all be done within about 2 weeks. So by the 1st of April, at least we're hoping that we'll be able to do the test in-house.
And how long would you expect the turnaround to be on that as far as getting results?
Yeah, right. That's a good question. Probably, I don't know, 4 to 6 hours at the longest, but that's going to be a lot better than 4 to 5 days.
Yeah, one thing that I learned in the past week is that, I mean, in some cases, I don't know about all cases, but certainly the health department doesn't investigate the confirmed cases communication situation, people that they may have exposed in until they're confirmed. So you've got this period of time where other people who may have been able to be notified sooner are not notified until after the fact.
Well, you know, that's a good point. That's another reason why it's very important for us to get expeditious results of these tests so that we can appropriately, you know, trace patients who indeed are contacts of these positives, because they're going to have to be monitored as well.
Okay, 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. We have Ron on the line. Hi, Ron. What's your question or comment?
Well, the top one was was addressed just now. Finally, some clarity on sampling versus analysis. This has caught everyone by surprise. I understand that. But I think the doctor just addressed everything in regards to detection. I was in hazardous waste operations for 22 years and certified. We needed 4-year refresher. We responded to, in the business I responded, but I did search and discovery of hazardous waste. Still worked on numerous Superfund sites. I was in charge of health and safety plans, work plans, in QAQC plan, and we need to adapt. If we don't have PPE, first we need to train people in the front lines about PPE and the concept. I was sampled Monday. I've seen, you know, that's just desperately needed. We need to incorporate cartridges and mouthwash for when people do need to go out in public.
Ron, are you saying that you were tested for the coronavirus on Monday?
Yeah, Monday. I was supposed to find out my results today. So I was really agitated about what the information I was getting about when I was going to be told.
Have you been told?
And no, I was told. I was told. It was 2-3 days. They said that it was Monday that I went in, and they pretty much check you out. I've got the flu, you know. So they give you discharge papers about the flu, but this flu is really kind of weird. It just has characteristics that. But it takes you for a ride. Its first week is almost undetectable with sniffling. Then the second week kicks in, and you got to go for a ride of just joint pain, neck pain, back pain, just weird stuff like that. Not overall body ache like a normal flu. So
okay, well, Ron, let me ask you this: since we have you, Ron, and you're dealing with this, do you have a question that you'd like to address to Dr. File that maybe he could help you out with?
Well, you know, I want to. I think I'm over this. But I want to train people on the concepts of PPE, the modifications that we have to make when we don't have it, using vents at home for oven. I'm in an old folks community. I can't do my laundry. We need a question call place for the people who have know what to do about quarantine.
Okay, Ron, we do appreciate your call very much. Thank you so much for calling in. And Dr. File, I'm curious. You know, we hear that caller, Ron, who, you know, is expressing frustration, maybe experiencing symptoms and was tested. What do you hear from people who are dealing with that situation?
Well, I think very similar to what the caller said. I mean, everybody's a little bit concerned what is going to happen here. I think we still have to be reassured that 80-85% of the people who acquire this are going to do well. It's going to be a self-limited illness like another respiratory type of infection. However, you know, we do know that about 15, maybe 20% may require medical assistance, may, you know, hospitalization. Maybe a few of those are going to have to go in the intensive care unit. So it can be very serious, but I want to follow up on one thing that the caller said, and because this is very important, and that is the supply adequacy and the appropriate use of PPE, which just means personal protective equipment, because we've been preparing for this at our institution for the last 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, realizing that we were going to, you know, get cases. Now, remember, we didn't even have a first documented case in Ohio till last Monday or a week ago Monday. And so now it's ramping up quite significantly. But, you know, we've been counseling, educating all of our healthcare providers, whether they're nurses, physicians, respiratory therapists, dietitians, whatever their goal is or whatever their purpose is for patient care, to make sure that they know how to use the personal protective equipment, because they have to be very comfortable and they have to be very safe. I mean, our mission obviously is to care for patients if they're ill, but we also have to be safe because we don't want to lose our workforce. So I think the appropriate supply of PPE and appropriate use of PPE, as the caller mentioned, is extremely important. And now, he also mentioned that there's a spectrum of disease, that a lot of these people have mild disease, and then sometimes after 4 or 5 days, they get much worse, and that is true. But I also want to make the point, and this is really reinforces the need for social distancing, that a lot of patients, we don't know yet exactly how many, but a lot of patients, and we'll know more as we do more testing, can have this infection and not be sick. And so they're circulating in the community and potentially spreading it. And that's why we need the social distancing, because when you separate people, you know, for a certain amount of distance, or let's say 5 or 6 feet, and don't have a lot of people in the same room, then those asymptomatic people, the people who could be infected but are not sick, are less likely to spread it to other people. That's why it's extremely important, and I'm sure that's why New York and Los Angeles have been even more strict in their policies.
And Dr. File, I know you've got to run. I'll let our listeners know that we do have another doctor coming on right behind you to address their calls, so stay on hold and call us at 513-419-7100. But before we let you go, Dr. File, I'm curious, you know, being an expert in infectious disease, Have you learned anything that you didn't know before amid this pandemic?
Well, right. I mean, we've seen some other pandemics. I mean, if you recall, about 10 years ago, we had H1N1. Fortunately, although that was a pandemic as well, and, you know, a high percentage of the population were infected, the mortality rate was very, very low. So that was very good. Obviously, we saw the epidemic, not a pandemic, with the Ebola, which is quite concerning. But this is somewhat unprecedented. I've been in the practice now for 40 years, and this is obviously the most significant of the responses to a pandemic in which I've been involved. So this is a very unique and very challenging time because of that. And, you know, a lot of us in the healthcare system are spending a lot extra time than we had a month ago.
Do you expect to have access to some of the new drugs that appear to have some loosening rules from the FDA?
Yeah, that's a good point. And yes, as we have more data to show the efficacy of these antiviral agents, I suspect that they will be allowed to be used very quickly in expedited use. But we need the data. I mean, we have to make sure that if we're giving these medicines, that they truly have evidence that they are going to benefit patients and not cause necessarily adverse events. So that is important. And I think as we get these data from clinical trials, it's going to be extremely important.
Dr. Thomas Feil is with Summa Health Infectious Diseases Society of America. We so appreciate your time, Dr. Feil. Thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure, Michael.
Coming up, we've got another doctor joining us live to answer your questions at 513-419-7100. I want to remind you, coming up at 12:30, there is a news conference that the city of Cincinnati is hosting regarding what they are calling an important update on the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in Cincinnati. We'll try to bring you that information as soon as we have it as well. A little later, we'll talk with Duke Energy about the changing in its collection policies as families see uncertainty in their financial future. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our coronavirus discussion, and joining us live on the phone is TriHealth Physicians Partners Infectious Diseases Medical Director, Dr. Stephen Blatt. Dr. Blatt, thank you for your time today.
Good morning. How are you?
We are well and so grateful for your time. And I know our callers on the line also have many questions about COVID-19 as well. Others can call in at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your questions there. Dr. Blatt, as we are months into this situation here in this country, and it seems to be growing in severity each and every day, what is your top concern right now as a medical professional in this field?
I think there are two. One is the testing and getting the test results back in a timely fashion. The testing labs have been really backed up, and it's taking days and days to get the results back, so it's hard to make decisions about patient management without actually having a diagnosis. And I think the second is just the unknown about how many cases we're going to have. I feel like here in Cincinnati, the health systems are ready, and fortunately, the surge has not occurred yet. We have lots of open beds and plenty of capacity, but it feels like it's the calm before the storm.
God, that's concerning for sure. Let's go to the phones and take some of our listeners' questions now and see if you can help us out with some of them, Dr. Blatt. We'll go to Garrett. Garrett's on the line. Hi, Garrett. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm the village council president of Sailor Park, and we have an issue involving the school board right now. And I don't want to disparage our superintendent, Laura, because I think she's fantastic. But demographically, Sailor Park is the oldest and therefore at most risk neighborhood in the city. And our only health care clinic is in the school. Now that the schools are closed, we don't have a health care clinic in our community at all. And well, basically, the NPs and the doctors in these types of communities have access to the clinics. They can get in if they have permission, but right now the school board isn't giving them that permission to get in and give people critical health care right now. So we're asking the school board to allow those clinics to be open.
Garrett, we do appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling in. And I guess it's we would need to reach out to the school board before we frame any questions about that to make sure that we understand both perspectives on that. But Dr. Blatt, for people in communities that feel like they can't access a health clinic and need to, what is the word for medical professionals right now?
Well, the current recommendation is if you're having symptoms of fever and a respiratory illness, but if you're doing okay, you're not having severe shortness of breath or chest pain or unrelenting high fever, is to stay home, drink plenty of fluids, and take care of yourself. Since there's no specific treatment for this particular virus that's approved, predominantly, home care will be the main treatment for most healthy people that will be able to get through it without needing admission to a hospital.
And we're talking with Dr. Stephen Blatt. He is from TriHealth Physician Partners. He's an infectious diseases medical director there. We'll go back to the phone lines now. We have Kirk on the line. Hi, Kirk. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I live in Richmond, Indiana, and I noticed that my mail carrier isn't wearing gloves. And I know that the virus lives a long time on paper, and I'm worried about it. I called the post office, and they said that right now the mail carriers aren't required to wear gloves.
Okay, Kirk, we appreciate that call and that question. Dr. Blatt, I guess the question is about how the virus may stay on surfaces, including mail, and whether it can be transmitted that way.
Yeah, so it can stay on surfaces, but not for a long time. It's not a very hardy virus, and I think the likelihood of acquiring it on a piece of mail would be extremely, extremely low. I would presume that if the mail carriers are ill, they would be off as well. I think the bigger concern is staying away from sick patients who might be coughing or, having symptoms of respiratory illness that would be the source of transmission.
513-419-7100 is the number to call. We go now to Don. Hi, Don. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I was traveling down south around the country before the coronavirus sort of became a thing. And then as it became, more and more prevalent, we started working our way home. And when we got back home on Monday, I was diagnosed with pneumonia. A little bit of background, I'm a cancer patient, slightly immunosuppressed. And when I went to the emergency room and they diagnosed me with the pneumonia, they said that based on my symptoms and based on the fact that I had been traveling, that I qualified to be tested for COVID-19. And so they ran the test, and this was this past Monday. I was discharged from the hospital yesterday. I still haven't received any results from my test, but they cleared my pneumonia, and I was 24 hours without a fever, and so they sent me home, told me to self-quarantine, take care of myself, and that I should get the results within the next 3 or 4 days. I guess my question is, during my travel, we spent, the night with, friends and family along the way. I feel sort of, I'm confused as to whether we should contact them, say, I've been tested, you guys should be isolated until I get my results, or, and then inconvenience them knowing that most people are testing negative. What would you recommend
there? Don, thank you so much for your call, and we wish you recovery with the cancer, and wish you a good prognosis with the results of your COVID-19 test. Thank you for your call. We'll let Dr. Blatt take an answer on that. Dr. Blatt, I guess the question is, Don is concerned that he doesn't have his results yet. He does meet some of the criteria for the higher risk population, and he had been around people. Should he contact those people he had been around?
Yeah, so that's a tough one, and that's where this testing lag is really hurting us. Ideally, he would know the results now, and he'd be able to tell them if he really did have the disease, and he wouldn't have to worry about it if he didn't. Knowing more about his case might be helpful, or he could talk to his own doctor to see whether his own physician thinks it's a good idea to contact those people. There are certain characteristics of pneumonia that are more suggestive of the COVID-19 disease versus routine pneumonias, which are have different characteristics. So I think there would probably be no harm in telling those people that he's waiting for the test to come back. Sounds like it's probably not likely that he has it, as he mentioned. But again, it's very hard to tell. So we really need to get the lab testing system up to speed so that we can get these results back to people in a timely fashion.
Okay, next on the line is Roger. Hi, Roger. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I was wondering how people who are asymptomatic are able to spread the disease.
Good question, Roger. We appreciate the call. Dr. Blatt, asymptomatic people, how likely are they to spread?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to answer. But there have been case reports where a person without symptoms is shedding the virus in their respiratory secretions, and they have infected, say, family members or close contacts with the virus. So we don't know how often that occurs. We don't know for how many days before a patient develops symptoms they might be shedding virus, and we don't know for how long after they recover they're shedding virus. So those are some really important research questions to answer, and it's probably one of the reasons why this virus spreads so efficiently is because it can spread from asymptomatic carriers.
Okay, I want to let our listeners know that what we're hearing from the city building where that news conference is underway involving the city manager, the mayor, and the health commissioner, that there are now confirmed, there are four confirmed cases in the city of Cincinnati. They range in ages from 31 to 70, three males and one female, one person is hospitalized. That is the update from City Hall, that there are four positive coronavirus cases in the city of Cincinnati. Will bring you more details on air and online at WVXU.org. Back to the phones now. We have Becky up next. Hi, Becky. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. Hey, thanks you guys for doing this. I called my doctor, and they're so busy they can't answer the question. But I am 59 years old, and I have asthma. And I've used my Dulera inhaler to keep it at bay, and it's the asthma has been well under control for a number of years. However, if I don't use it, you know, I definitely start experiencing symptoms. Anyway, so the last few days I've definitely been having some symptoms that seem to correlate with what the description is for the virus. And my question is, if I use my inhaler, will I just be opening my lungs up even deeper so that the infection can go down deeper? Or would it be better for me not to use the inhaler for a while and let it kind of stay closed up and, you know, maybe not as open so that it would ward off getting more of the virus deeper into those little hairs and stuff at the bottom?
Dr. Blatt, I'll let you handle that.
Yeah, so I think it's really important to take as good a care of your asthma as you can, and keeping your lungs open with your inhalers is important. I would not hesitate to use your inhaler. I don't think you're going to open up your lungs and be more at risk of getting the infection. My concern is if you don't keep your lungs in good shape and you do come across COVID, you'd have a harder time of it.
Becky, thank you so much for the call. Good luck out there. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join us here on Cincinnati Edition. I'm Michael Monks. I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Blatt. He is the TriHealth Physician Partners Infectious Diseases Medical Director. We go now to Peter. Hi, Peter. What's your question or comment?
My question is, once you're exposed and have the virus, it's confirmed, how long are you likely to keep the virus before you are pronounced recovered? And how long after you're recovered are you immune to being re-sick?
Okay, Peter, we'll hang up and let Dr. Blatt answer that question. It looks like a two-parter, Dr. Blatt. I guess, how long should someone expect to be sick? I assume that there's probably some varying circumstances in that question. And then, are you immune after?
Right, so the range of illness is quite broad, but most people it's about 7 to 10 days, just like a lot of common respiratory viruses. And then most people recover fully and don't ever have any problem again. The duration of immunity is not known. We do know that people develop antibodies against the virus, which should provide immunity, but we don't know how long-lasting that is, and that will be a big part of the research that will follow this pandemic.
Okay, next on the line is Ralph. Hi, Ralph. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I was shopping last night with my wife, and we were at a Kroger in Union, Kentucky, and I was dumbfounded to see that they have a self-service olive bar, they have a salad bar, they have a self-service bakery where you get donuts and whatnot, bagels and the like, using tongs. Nobody there to disinfect anything. I'm dumbfounded that these are even remaining open in the time of a national pandemic.
Ralph, thank you so much for the call. Dr. Blatt, is there any concern in the medical community about self-serve, I guess, communally self-serving buffets and grocery items?
Well, there's some question about whether this virus can be spread via what we call a fecal-oral route, where people could shed the virus in their stool, get it on their hands, and then contaminate food sources, which could end up being a source for infection, sort of like hepatitis A would be. And again, we don't know how often that occurs or whether it's even significant, but there is some evidence that that's a possibility. So I would think at least having these self-serve sites wiped down frequently and perhaps having gloves for people to use when they obtain food from them would be a good idea.
And Dr. Blatt, we've got a tough question for you on Twitter that I think if you have the answer to, you may become a very wealthy man. But the question is, how does it end? Quote, this is from Gus on Twitter. How does it end if all we're doing is, quote, flattening the curve and the number of people under the curve is the same? What sets the number or the end time of the curve? Does it all start over again and we go back to normal life?
Well, that's a really, really good question, and nobody certainly knows the answer to that. I've seen some estimates that people think that this may become what we call an endemic virus, where it's always circulating at a low level in the community, and it may pop up here and there. People will get sick, and then it'll kind of go away as the population becomes immune. But again, like a lot of viruses like the flu, we continue to deal with that every year. The flu is a serious, serious illness. People die from the flu at a much higher rate than we're seeing in many cases with COVID. So it may be that it'll just be one of those viruses that's around that we'll have to deal with for the future.
And the concern in the medical community is bed capacity, right? Respirator capacity.
Right.
And what should the general public be concerned about as it relates to that? Like, I think people are concerned about getting sick, right? But what should we know about the impact on the system itself should this come to fruition?
Well, that's the whole idea behind flattening the curve, so that we don't have a huge spike of critically ill patients that we don't have a capacity to care for in our hospital systems. So we do probably have a limited supply of ventilators to keep people alive while their lungs heal after a severe case of coronavirus COVID disease. But if we can reduce the number that are ill at any one time, we can spread that out over time and do the best that we can for most of the patients so that the healthcare system does not become completely overwhelmed. It's just a very few patients or a very small percentage of patients that need that high-intensity critical care, but of the ones who need it, they'll die if they don't get it.
We got a question on Twitter from Tim. He says, I have heard people start with symptoms that have either not been tested or sent home to self-quarantine due to lack of test. At what point or level of symptoms should people know that they need to go back to be tested or just stay home to ride out the virus?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And I think the things that we tell patients to watch for are severe shortness of breath. So if you're getting more and more short of breath where you're having trouble, say, walking across the room or going up a flight of stairs when you normally don't have that problem, you need to go back. If you start having chest pain or other difficulty breathing issues, you should go back. And I think if you have a persistent very high fever, you know, over 103, 104 that's not coming down, you should be reevaluated.
And we got a question from Peter on our Instagram channel, and he wants to know what is being done to increase test and supply of PPE to hospitals. I'm sure that's something that people in your profession right now, Dr. Blatt, are keeping tabs on.
Yeah, for sure. So every day our hospital system has twice a day updates on the availability of testing specimens, the availability of PPE. We are getting new test kits in on a daily basis. And also within the Cincinnati community, we're sharing test kits with systems that are running low. And we're also getting additional PPE from the national stockpile that's available. So we have a disaster planning committee here that is in contact with the national disaster system, and we're able to acquire additional PPE through that system.
We were joined earlier in the hour by another doctor in Ohio, and we asked the same question. We know that some regulations related to drugs are being loosened. Is that something that you're monitoring? What can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, there are some. The FDA has made some changes to allow medications to be more readily available. That's a good thing, and also you have to be careful, though, because you don't want to use medications that are actually dangerous for patients. So pretty much all the systems in the country are looking at using some medications, what we call off-label. So medications that were developed for other reasons might be available to treat patients with COVID-19. For example, there's a malaria drug called chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine that does have some activity against the virus, and some early studies show that it may shorten the duration of viral shedding if you take that medication. So that's being looked at very closely.
We know there's a lack of access to tests, at least in the volume that some medical care providers are hoping to have, but I'm wondering if there's any concern about false negative tests?
Well, there always is a concern about false negatives. So, you know, in some of the other COVID-like outbreaks like SARS, early in the course of the disease, the sensitivity of the test was only maybe 70%, meaning 30% of the patients who actually had the disease tested negative. So that's a very important question, but we don't have the answer to it as to what is the sensitivity of the test early in the course of disease with COVID-19.
What do you find is the most common question that people in your healthcare system are getting from people?
I think the one of the more important questions is this question of transmission from the either asymptomatic patients or minimally symptomatic patients, and it's one of the more difficult things to plan for or to prevent. So, you know, typically we are testing people for fever when they come into our buildings. We are monitoring for respiratory symptoms. But if there's a significant number of people who are transmitting the disease who have no symptoms or no fever, that's a much more difficult thing to prevent.
Dr. Stephen Blatt is TriHealth Physician Partners Infectious Diseases Medical Director. Dr. Blatt, so grateful for all the answers that you gave our listeners today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Up next, we talk to Duke Energy, and the company spokesperson explains its change in collection policy amid the financial challenges that are expected from this global pandemic. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.